This is a production of Cornell University.
All right, I think we are at the 4:32 mark. We'll go ahead and call the Foods and Judicial Committee meeting to order here. We'll go ahead and do a roll call to get things started here. And then we have some special guests here that are going to be joining us for questions. We have a presentation or a conversation around the differences in the current code and the soon-to-be student code of conduct from the OJA and JCC offices. And then we do have, believe it or not, meeting minutes, which we haven't had in a while. So we have meeting minutes that we can review if you have already. And if we have the opportunity, we can look at the opportunity to approve those. So I'll go ahead and do a roll call here so we have that. And then we'll get started. Nick Denev is not here. Heather Donato here. Brandon is here, of course. Kat Wang is not here. Jen Michael is here. Laura Taylor is here. And Salam Wolde is not here. All right. With that, I think because we did cut down our numbers, we do have a quorum for this evening, because I think we're down to 8, if I count that right. 1, 2. Oh, Risa, I forgot to call your name. You're here. Sorry. Yeah, so we do have quorum. Okay. All right. So with that, we're going to go ahead and get started. First, I want to welcome our guest this evening, and I'll let them introduce themselves so that I don't give titles incorrectly. I apologize for that. So I ask Kevin to give us a quick introduction.
Hi, my name is Kevin Williams. My pronouns are he, him, his. I'm joining Cornell this semester to help them transition as a consultant to transition from one student code of conduct to the next code of conduct. So I'm serving in a consulting role. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And those of you on the CJC recall, we had made a vote to have Kevin come and join us. And in speaking with Kevin, he thought it very important to have Marla Love join us as well. So just based on kind of since we last voted to have Kevin join us, things have progressed quite a bit. And Marla is very involved in the process. So Marla, please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Marla Love. I use the pronoun she, her. I'm serving as the interim dean of students. And I'm working closely with Kevin as he transitions the code, the potential future director of the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards will report to the Dean of Students.
Thank you so much, Marla. I'm impressed that you've got that acronym all worked out now. I've bumbled through it a few times when I'm trying to get all the words right in there and get them backwards. So welcome to both of you. I'm very happy to have you. Like I said, I'd like to, if it's okay with Marissa and Christina, start off with the conversation around the comparison of the current and the new student code. And I think that will give us a good opportunity to hear some things that we may not have thought about as far as the code goes. And then this will give us an opportunity to ask questions of both Marissa and Christina, and then perhaps transition over to some questions for Kevin and Marla, how these changes and things might impact the student body and how best we as the CJC can be of support to the office there as this goes through. So I don't know if either Christina or Marissa, one of you had a game plan as to who's going first and everything. And if you had a presentation you need to do, just let me know.
Yeah, so Marissa and I put together a presentation. We'd like to share it with the group so I can have some share screen authority.
That good to go.
Thank you, Gina. So bear with me. And I'm going to start the presentation so we can also utilize the subtitling that PowerPoints allow us to use. Okay. Testing. Okay, I think it's working now. Great. All right, so this is the code comparison that the Office of the Judicial Administrator and Office of the Judicial Codes Counselor is putting together for you. It is meant to be kind of a broad overview. And so Marissa and I had a chance to meet and kind of do a brief run through, and we anticipate it taking about 25 to 30 minutes or so. So we're hoping to get through the presentation and then happy to take some questions towards the end. All right, here we go. Oh, little click. Okay. So to start off, I think it's really helpful to see kind of a flow chart, a visual representation of our current campus code of conduct process. So again, this is the current code. I don't know how familiar folks are, but we'll just kind of walk you through it. The flow chart works from left to right. So that's how we're going to proceed through this slide. So everything in the current campus code of conduct begins with an incident report. Some type of report is made to the conduct office, and then there are some decisions that need to be made. The left box on the bottom left there is an option where the JA's office, we can close a report without any investigation. And the reason for that is because perhaps there isn't jurisdiction. Right? And a classic example I'll provide is if something's reported to the JA's office, but it actually is a potential violation of policy 6.4, then that's inappropriate for it to be handled under the campus code. And we would refer that incident report over to the Title IX office. So that would be an option. Also in that left box, you'll see another option is for us to open an investigation and actually reach the conclusion that a respondent is not responsible, right? There can be a whole bunch of reasons for that. One of the main reasons is we didn't meet our burden of proof, our standard of proof. Right? So that's one option of what can happen. That middle purple box that you'll see, it's purple because an overwhelming majority of the campus code of conduct cases are resolved through this method, which is our informal resolution process, also known as a summary decision agreement. This informal resolution is where a respondent and a representative from the JA's office is able to reach an agreement that there were some violations and what are the appropriate sanctions. And like I said, I would say overwhelming number of resolutions are resolved in this manner. And then also to the right, you'll see that there can be a situation where the JA's office, we open and conduct an investigation. We do think that there is a violation of the code of conduct, but there wasn't a summary decision agreement that's reached between the respondent and the JA's office. That does happen. And in that situation, and only that situation, do we proceed to something called a hearing, which is the formal resolution process up towards the top in the middle there. And a hearing on the merits is a situation where the university hearing and review board get involved. They hear all the relevant information and determine whether a respondent is in violation of the code. And if the answer is yes, they also determine the appropriate sanctions. And so this is part of the process where in the past couple of weeks, the CJC has been talking about the hearing board. That's where the hearing board would get involved in that kind of narrower bucket of cases that are not resolved informally. For hearings, there's an opportunity for two levels of appeal. The first level is to the university review board. And the review board it's the same pool of people. They're basically a separate group of people who would review a hearing board's decision. And finally, in cases involving violence, there's another level of appeal that goes directly to President Pollack. Okay. So this is kind of a very broad 30,000 foot review of the current campus code of conduct. And so it only seems fair that we also created a graphic for the new student code of conduct. And it's slightly different, a couple more arrows, but I think it's a representative of kind of what the drafters intended to do, which is to create opportunities to resolve things informally. So we'll kind of start again from the left, right? Everything starts the same. There's an incident report that comes into the new student conduct office. I'm not going to even try to say OSCCS, it's a mouthful. The student conduct office, okay? And so an option here, the options look a little bit different. I will say that the current campus code of conduct process is very much complaint driven. Right? The fact that there's a complaint that comes to the office, that's how the process starts. The new student code of conduct is slightly different in that it is complainant driven, right? It really is emphasizing this involvement of the complainant, okay? And so in the left-hand side, you'll see here one option, once a report is submitted, is that a complainant does not pursue a formal complaint. I'll give you an example. Perhaps Marissa submits a complaint, right, to the student conduct office and alleges I don't know, I stole something from her, right? And so in this situation, my behavior is alleged to have harmed Marissa. And Marissa gets to decide in the new student code of conduct, do I want to pursue a formal complaint, right? Or is this a situation I just want to report it to the university and let them know that this is happening, okay? And so in this example, if there's no formal complaint, that's where the process would end, okay? In that middle box, the complainant does not pursue a formal complaint, but the director pursues a formal complaint on behalf of the university. So in this example, okay, Marissa has shared with the conduct office, you know what, I don't want to file a formal complaint against Christina. You know, maybe something's going on with Christina. I'm hoping somebody reaches out to Christina, gets her some help. Right? But come to find out from the conduct office, this is the fourth report, perhaps, that Christina may have taken something from another student. And now the conduct office might be concerned. Right? This is totally hypothetical, right? The conduct office might think, you know what, maybe there does need to be some type of conversation and process against Christina because there's a concerning pattern of behavior. And so in this situation, the director of conduct can actually pursue a formal complaint on behalf of the university. Okay. That third box, a complainant does sign a formal complaint. So this would be the scenario where Marissa says, yep, I'm reporting this behavior. I'd like to pursue a formal complaint. And that process begins in a very involved way involving the complaint, Marissa. Okay. So those are kind of the three different routes, right? When there's a formal complaint, there can be a situation where things can be resolved through that alternate resolution, which is that bottom box on the left. And this is where it's a purple box against because we anticipate this would be a majority of how cases would be resolved informally through this process. And what's, I think, unique about the new student code of conduct is it really codifies the idea that the director has the ability to resolve things informally and in a broad sense using restorative practices and opportunities that really embed restorative justice into the work. And so these are, I think, areas of great opportunity and exploration that the new conduct office will be tasked with. Now, all this is kind of part of the process, but I think what remains true and exists under the new student code of conduct is this idea of an investigation, which is that middle box up top. Okay? Investigations continue, right? We need to gather information, find out what happened in a situation, and whether what happened is indeed a violation of the student code of conduct. And so what that means then is as the investigation is continuing, the investigator, the assigned investigator, which would be a member of the student conduct office, would ultimately finish their investigation and complete something called an investigation report. This report is something that is then shared with a hearing panel for their consideration so that they can decide, is there a code of conduct violation? And if so, what are the appropriate sanctions? The hearing panel is very similar, I would say, to the current university hearing and review board. Right. There's a lot more, I think, decision-making and asking of questions that the new hearing panel may be tasked with, as opposed to the current hearing process in the code where, a representative from the respondent and the JA's office does a large majority of the questions. Okay. So if there is an alternate resolution being pursued, I think it's really important also to note that that's when there is a pause in the investigation. Okay. And that I think is to honor the fact that there is something that is informal in the process towards resolution. And so that's something that I want to note as well. If there is a hearing panel who makes the decision after an investigation, the panel makes that decision and it can be appealed. There's one level of appeal to a review panel. And that review panel reviews the decision of the hearing panel. Right. So that's kind of an overview of the new student code of conduct process. I think the additional arrows just really indicate, I think, that these off-ramps that were part of the discussion when drafting this new code, opportunities to resolve things informally. All right, moving along.
So Christina and I wanted to sort of start with this 5,000-foot view of the two processes and how they sort of align and are different from one another. And I think, the way we think about it is as you start to zoom in, the next thing that you look at are the actual you know, the actual documents. And if you had the current campus code of conduct open at the same time as the new student code and the procedures, I think, you know, there are a couple main differences you would notice. So one is that the current code is just one big document, and that includes the violations, the principles that sort of underlie the code, the UHRB procedures, and the procedures. And in the new code, we've sort of separated out those procedures from the code itself. So the code also starts with principles, just like the current code, and then goes into sort of what the violations are, what is a violation of the code, how do you comply with the code, and then to get into the mechanics of what the process that Christina just described looks like, that would be found in the procedures. And I think another big change you'd notice is that the new code is a bit shorter, even though it is in two documents. And I think that was very intentional, an effort to sort of streamline and simplify a lot of the language.
The next piece that, Yes, okay. Wasn't sure if the slide changed. Another, I think, kind of broad change that occurred is pertaining to jurisdiction. So who does the code apply to? What are the circumstances that apply under the code of conduct? So the current code covers students, faculty, employees in a non-employment setting, and university registered organizations, hence the name Campus Code of Conduct. And then in situations involving off-campus behavior, off-campus behavior is only part of the code's jurisdiction if it is a serious violation, and there must be approval by the Dean of Students, VP Human Resources, or the Dean of Faculty to exercise that jurisdiction. In the new code of conduct, we know the jurisdiction only extends to students and student organizations. There is an expansion in terms of including university recognized and registered organizations. And so for some additional context, university recognized organizations are our social Greek organizations. They currently fall under a recognition policy. So all of those groups will also now fall under the student code of conduct. In terms of off-campus jurisdiction under the new code, if there is behavior that occurs off-campus, that is in the context of the university program or activity, or poses a threat to the university's educational mission, health, safety of individuals, or the university community, then there's no secondary approval that's required to exercise off-campus jurisdiction. So this new language is meant to provide some guidance to the conduct office to really understand what is the type of behavior that occurs perhaps off-campus but might still affect our community.
So another major difference between the current code and the new code is the process for amending the code. You know, one criticism that some individuals had of the current code was that it was too difficult to amend it. And so one change that came out of the reform process was to basically shift the, so the code is currently vested with the University Assembly and the Board of Trustees. And so currently the University Assembly, which delegates a lot of sort of the granular detailed work to this committee, the Codes and Judicial Committee, will propose amendments to the code, and then President Pollack and the Board of Trustees sort of have the final say. Under the new code, the Vice President of Student and Campus Life has the ultimate authority of the code, and the code also creates a Code and Procedures Review Committee, which will include representatives from the Student Assembly and then the Graduate and Professional Student Assembly, and perhaps some other individuals. Some of that still needs to be fleshed out, who will essentially advise the Vice President of Student and Campus Life to make sure that there's sort of an ear to the ground as the amendment process unfolds. One thing that I think is really great is that you know, the elected assembly still have the ability to propose amendments to the code. So any of the assemblies, that could be the university assembly, the student assembly, the employee assembly, faculty senate, can propose an amendment to the code, and then that amendment would go to this committee that the Vice President of Student Campus Life sits as the chair as, and sort of consider the merits of that amendment. So There are a couple different ways that the process can be initiated under the new code, but the ultimate authority is in a different place. And it's, I think, a little bit easier to change sort of smaller things that individuals might just notice are not working once you have the text and then you start to see it in practice. I know Christina and I have already talked about some of those little things.
Right. Another kind of basic change is office name change. But I do think that this is a really critical piece that will assist with the shift to an educational and restorative process. So currently, the Office of the Judicial Administrator, we also have the Office of Judicial Codes Counselors. And the new code, the new conduct office will be called the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards. And then we also have the Office of the Respondents Codes Counselor and the Office of Complainants Codes Counselor. And this is reflective of the shift in the code to also emphasize that it is a complainant-driven process. You know, language is really powerful, and I do think that the switch to, you know, substitute words like judicial can really help students better understand what is the purpose of this process, what is the purpose of this office and all the different people who are working in this process.
Okay, so then just looking at sort of the organizational structure of the current JA's office and the future OSCCS office, that doesn't quite roll off my tongue yet, but I'm working on it. Currently, the Office of the Judicial Administrator is an independent office with an administrative relationship to the president. The JA can be removed only by the president's office and the Board of Trustees. Under the new code, you know, similar to the authority of the actual document changing, the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards will be oriented under the Vice President of Student and Campus Life. The idea being to have sort of a more direct working relationship with sort of the arm of campus that is connected directly to students, in the spirit of this being a student code. And the director of this new office will report directly to the Vice President of Student Campus Life or their designee, which is Marla, I believe, who's here with us today.
All right. Next, moving to the different roles of people who are part of the conduct process, one of the significant changes here is the role of the investigator. So currently, we have assistant and associate judicial administrators who investigate and resolve cases. They have both of those responsibilities and roles. And during the hearing process, the AJAs also assume kind of somewhat of a prosecutorial role, and they present cases on behalf of the complainant, whether it's an individual or a university complaint. So under the new code, though, the investigator role kind of splits, right? The investigators are now only responsible for investigating. They create an investigative report that does not include any proposed outcomes. It also does not include any recommendations for sanctions, and really assuming that neutral investigator role. What that also means then is that if there is an opportunity to resolve things through the alternate resolution, that would be resolved by a different person to really make sure that the process holds up to the integrity and the idea that we have a neutral and independent investigator handling the matter, separate from the person handling the alternate resolution. At a hearing, the hearing panel, so the members of this board and the chair, are the individuals responsible for calling witnesses, asking questions to help them make their decision as to whether there's a violation, and if so, what are the appropriate sanctions. The calling of witnesses may or may not include the investigator. And the idea is that having this initial report that's shared with the panel might be helpful from an efficiency perspective, but also just organization of the information that's been gathered prior to the hearing process.
So similarly, sort of the process for appointing procedural advisors and also those advisors, what their participation in the process looks like, is actually mostly the same, but there are some differences. So in the current code, we have the Office of the Judicial Codes Counselor, which is becoming the Office of the Respondents Codes Counselor. the current eligibility for members of our office is to law students only. Under the new code, we've expanded that to law students and also graduate and professional students who might have prior experience that could be related. So that could be, you know, maybe they were a mediator or they worked in a student conduct office or really anything along those lines. I think, you know, we take a broad view of what that looks like. And then obviously the complainants codes counselor's office is new. That's also stemming from a current office of individuals who work with complainants under Title IX. So they do already do a lot of this work, but now are expanding this work to the code. Currently, the JCC, so I was appointed by the president with the concurrence of the University Assembly. Moving forward, the appointment process is going to be that the lead counselor is appointed by the Student Assembly, the GPSA, and the OSA in consultation with the director. And that'll start kind of the following year. So when I graduate in a week or so, Susanna will be the lead respondents code counselor, and then we'll embark on this process in the future. And then the same thing kind of goes for removal, the SA and GPSA again, with concurrence of the director. And similar to the current language, you know, removal is only supposed to be if there's a significant dereliction of duty or gross misconduct, if someone's not doing their job or, you know, blatantly violating university policy or something along those lines. And then participation, you know, this was talked about a lot in the revision process. Currently, the JCCs can participate fully on behalf of students who are respondents in any hearing. In the future, that will remain the same, essentially, if, you know, suspension or dismissal are on the table. But in other cases, a lot of that participation is going to move more into the written requests and objection kind of realm of things, as opposed to verbal participation, although there is kind of space for a hearing board chair to use their discretion, because, you know, we recognize that every case is a little bit different. So those are kind of the main differences. But I think you'll see overall this element is pretty similar.
The identity of complainants has also shifted slightly. So in the current code, any individual Cornell community member who is personally harmed by the behavior of a respondent can be a complainant. So this would be that example we used earlier of me allegedly taking something of Marissa's, right? In that situation, Marissa would be an individual complainant, and then I would be the respondent. Right. When there isn't an individual complaint that exists, though, the OJA in the current code of conduct would serve as a university complainant. So that's actually an overwhelming number of what our cases are. So, for example, if there's documented underage drinking occurring in the residence halls, right, there's not an individual that's been harmed by that behavior, but it is a possible violation of the code of conduct. That would be a situation where there's no individual complainant, but the JA's office would represent the university as a university complainant. In the new code of conduct, if there is an individual Cornell community member who's harmed by the behavior of a respondent, they're identified as an individual complainant. That's their designation. In situation where there's a university or institutional interest, the BPSCL or the designee would appoint a designated individual to represent the complainant. So this could be, for example, Cornell Police. This could be an RA or perhaps someone who's representing the Department for Housing and Residence Life. That's another piece that I think, you know, has to be fleshed out as the code is implemented to see what that will look like.
Okay. This is an area that I'm very excited about. I think a lot of us are excited about this. You know, just a movement towards more opportunities to integrate alternate dispute resolution and restorative justice under the new code. A lot of this sort of remains, I think, to be fleshed out, but I think that's an exciting opportunity for us. Currently, I guess where we are in the campus code is that there really isn't any language formally in the code that either allows or like that, I guess, creates alternate dispute resolution or restorative justice. Although the Office of the Judicial Administrator does work with the Scheinman Institute to refer some cases to mediation. But I think, you know, the number of cases that organization has the capacity to process is limited. And so that also limits the amount of cases that the OJA's office can refer in their direction. You know, typically it's alcohol, first-time alcohol violations. We see a lot of those, you know, maybe a theft at the campus store kind of case. Your sort of more minor violations, often with first-time respondents, are going to be often given an option at the beginning of the process when they're notified of a potential violation to pursue mediation. In the new process, you know, the code explicitly requires that those opportunities are expanded upon. And it also, I think, draws some good lessons from the current policy 6.4 process, where sort of any party can request to explore a different way, a more informal way of settling a complaint, instead of just having to have the conduct office or the OJA offer that opportunity. A respondent could bring it up, a complainant could bring it up, or, you know, the director or investigator could bring that up. And it also allows for that to happen at any point in the process. So, you know, someone could start informal proceedings and then realize actually there might be a different or better way to resolve this complaint, and can sort of shift courses. So that ability to both expand this part of the code and then also allow more parties to make the request and make that request at different times in the process, I think is a strength and a difference.
All right. Standard of proof, there was a lot of discussion during the revision process about the standard of proof. So our current campus code of conduct uses clear and convincing evidence for both individuals and organizations. The new student code of conduct uses clear and convincing for individuals, and we're shifting to use preponderance of the evidence for student organizations. All right, so we spent some time talking about the procedures and what are the changes there. We want to switch gears now to talk about the violation section of the code. There's been some, generally, I'd say there's better organization in terms of listing the violations. So right now, the current campus code of conduct, we just kind of number them. There's, you know, the 3B provision, the 1G provision. And when we're talking to students, you know, unless you're really well-versed in the code of conduct, you don't really know what those things mean. And so the new campus code, the new student code of conduct actually alphabetizes these provisions and gives them names, right? So the alcohol provision, the theft provision, things like that. And it just makes it a lot more user-friendly. There's merging of violations that currently appear in two different titles into one section in the new student code of conduct. And there's actually also reference into the new student code of conduct regarding the Good Samaritan Protocol, which is the university policy that provides immunity for students if they call for help, if someone is experiencing adverse effect from drug and or alcohol use. So it actually is referenced in the code of conduct. I'll just kind of run through some of the specific changes that we noticed in some of those provisions. So for alcohol, the alcohol provision, there is now an added kind of sub-bullet that references public intoxication. Collusion and complicity is a new provision of the student code of conduct. Disruption of university activities. This was something that is somewhat new in the sense that the current campus code spends quite significant attention, and understandably so, at the beginning of the campus code of conduct to talk about the right to protest, the opportunity to express our opinions and thoughts in a meaningful way. And then it also, of course, discusses exceptions to that, when there might be protests that might be a disruption to university activity. In the new student code, it kind of makes it into its own individual provision. Drug-related behavior, that provision now adds the possession of drug paraphernalia, as well as DUIs, driving under the influence. Failure to comply is also somewhat of a new provision. The current failure to comply provision under the campus code is a bit narrower. It talks about failure to comply only in the context of if it's pertaining to public health and safety. So, for example, the student behavioral compact pertains to public health. That's a way that the current JA's office has been enforcing the compact by extension. Failure to comply under the new student code is a bit more broad. Harassment is a provision where there's kind of just some added explanations regarding clarity. surrounding protected speech. And so there's some language included there as well. The hazing definition under the new student code is also expanded to include things like living groups. So an example would be some of our, some of our living learning communities on North Campus, our co-ops, that's what I was trying to think of. Academic groups and cohorts are also potential groups that are included in the definition. Also included in the definition is this idea of engaging in dangerous or excessive acts that might be irrelevant to the purpose of the group. And of course, it also extends to on, off campus, in-person or virtual environments as well. A new provision that's been added to the student code is this misconduct related to student organizations and groups. This is really addressing behavior that might occur when there is an underground group. Right? So for example, there can be organizations that lose recognition or are suspended from the university. However, unfortunately, they still engage and operate similar to when they were recognized by the university. And so in those situations, individuals who are affiliating with those types of organizations can now be possibly held accountable under the new student code of conduct. Another bullet point identifies discrimination based on protected classes. That's not something that's okay under the new student code of conduct for organizations. And there is also this reference pertaining to dual jurisdiction based on the code, but also associated procedures. So perhaps an example I can provide is there will still be an event management guidelines document that pertains to our student organization. So for example, if there was an organization who was supposed to have wristbands, perhaps, provided an event that had alcohol involved, that might not be something that falls under the code, but perhaps falls under event management guidelines. A couple of other changes here. Misrepresentation is something that's somewhat of a new recategorization of some old provisions. So we used to have a, right now we have a forged ID, fake ID provision under the code. This will fall under this provision of misrepresentation. Obstruction with code of conduct investigation and adjudication process has been expanded to include, I think, a whole bunch of things, but I think the really kind of critical one here that we put in caps is this idea of retaliation. So the current code of conduct does not have a retaliation provision. And so unfortunately, we have had experiences working with situations of retaliation that we couldn't really do anything under the code of conduct because it's not part of our violations. But under the new code, it is against the student code to retaliate against someone who is participating in a code of conduct investigation. Violation of public laws is kind of a new provision. I think it's it'll be interesting to see kind of how that plays a part in enforcement of the new student code. And finally, weapons. This might be kind of a piece that's, you know, unique, but I would say it's really meaningful. And I see Marissa nod along. And that's because our current code, we have a provision called what we loosely call the endangerment provision. And it's got a whole bunch of things in there that talks about, that includes behavior like, messing around with an exit sign, right? Because that's endangering the community from a fire safety perspective. There's things in that provision that talk about physical altercations. And then there's also things in that provision that talk about brandishing a weapon. And so you can perhaps envision, you know, for a student who's found in violation of the endangerment provision, how scary that could be, right? If that's part of their disciplinary record. Under the new student code of conduct, the weapons provision specifically is pulled out of the endangerment provision. It's separate. And so that, I think, is really meaningful in creating more equity for our students and a proper representation of what behavior might be. All right, so kind of talked a lot about the process and procedures and really some of the bigger things that Marissa and I think that how does this affect all of us as a community, as a campus community? What are the implications of working with our campus partners as we implement the new student code of conduct? Certainly with a policy like this, there should be division and institutional wide training and or retraining, right? There will be a period of time when we might be using language that is no longer applicable, right? Like getting JA'd. I hope to see that kind of come and go in the next couple of years, right? An important part would be updating various campus policy websites, right? I think to properly usher in the new student code of conduct and the new offices that are related to the code. Student leader training regarding student organization misconduct, specifically social Greek organizations. Understandably, there's probably a lot of emotions and feelings about what this transition is going to look like, especially for groups who previously did not fall under the student code of conduct process. And then really, perhaps the most exciting piece and ongoing is creating more opportunities for collaborations with campus partners and also expanding restorative and ADR opportunities under the new student code. So, Marissa, do you want to add anything else? This is actually our last slide.
No, I think that's great. And I think we can just open it up to questions and have a conversation now.
Right. Stop share.
Well, let me start off with a huge thank you. That was really extremely helpful and beneficial. I think this would, I'm thinking, oh, we should have started off the semester with this, but I know that took a lot of time to really look at the documents, compare and contrast between those two. And I really, truly appreciate you taking the time to do that for this group here, because it definitely provides a great insight. I definitely learned things that I didn't catch in the revisions and the process. I didn't fully understand some of the aspects of the alternative resolution piece. So I definitely have some questions, but I don't want to take all the time. So I want to turn it over to if other folks have questions that have come up here. And I think one thing I might ask is now, Kevin and Marla, as we ask these questions, if you're open to being included in the question process and kind of making this sort of an open dialogue between all the groups here. I see a couple of head nods, so I think we're good there. So why don't I pause there and see if anyone has any questions. Well, then I will start. I guess one of the big things that kind of came to mind, and I really love that last slide about the training aspect, is do you envision this sort of presentation happening on a larger scale, like where you're doing that compare and contrast so people can understand how things have shifted for the organizations and for students? Now it gets awkward because who's going to answer the question, right?
Yeah, I'll just share, you know, as a member of the conduct office, I think it's critical that we talk about the differences and the changes that occur. I think it should be really audience-based, right? So when I think about our incoming first-year students, right, they won't really know about the old code of conduct. And in some ways, it can be somewhat confusing, right, to talk about a process and a policy that no longer exists. So I think it depends on the purpose of the presentation, the training, and what is the goal, right, behind it. But I do think we've kind of joked around using this term, but, you know, creating kind of a roadshow, right, to talk to different campus partners to educate and really receive feedback as well about what the new conduct process will look like is really important to the transition.
It's thank you, Christina. That's help. That's great. The presentation was great. Both of you, thank you so much for taking the time to put that together. This is all part of the rollout plan this summer, from orientation to student and leaders training to getting in front of all of you as part of that, and just continually rolling it out and making it an educational opportunity for the campus to understand what do we mean by community standards? What does it mean to be a part of the Cornell community? And to acknowledge that we understand that conflict is going to happen, behaviors are going to happen, but what then are the resources that are here, like the new conduct office, to support students as they navigate that, as partners for them, is part of our overall plan on how we roll this out.
Thank you very much. I think that's a great approach, and I like the roadshow idea, and I think that that's really a great technique to think about. You know, your audiences are going to change. You know, as I was thinking about, one of the big groups that I would say, and I think you kind of talked to, is those off-campus aspects, because in many instances, you know, students may feel that, you know, once I move off campus, there's a lot less of a concern here, and yeah, I gotta obey the laws, but as far as campus conduct goes, unless applicable. But now that's not the case. So thinking about how best to educate students to understand that, which I am a strong advocate for. I think that as Cornell students, they represent Cornell in the community and should be held to the same conduct standards. So I think that's really great to hear. Go ahead.
I was just going to add to that and just say that part of that conversation is comes from sort of also the other areas of particularly student and campus life that we are investing in to provide students with greater information, right? So Kevin sort of referenced sort of orientation as being one of the places where we make one of these roadshow stops. But I think as we are transitioning and as April Overstreet is working on sort of the orientation and developing sort of a new orientation structure and goal and purpose, it also is to make sure that some of these things about what does it mean to be a community member and what are you committing to are part of that earlier sort of onboarding to Cornell for students. So at other institutions, these sort of both of these things are hand in hand, orientation and sort of this conversation about rights and responsibilities. And so, you know, we hope to see the fruits of that over the next couple of years as orientation also shifts, as new student programs, as Res Life makes some shifts with the addition of Abby Priest in the Director of Residence Life role, that there'll be integrated moments where, or intentional moments where this won't just be a code that you run into because you've done something, but that you're more aware of prior to.
I think that's a great proactive approach there for sure. I met Abby this morning in Pat Wynn's meeting, so very excited to be working with Abby on future initiatives there. So, yes, Risa, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. I have a question that I'm sure that, I know I'm directing to Kevin and Marla, but also Marissa and Christina may well have responses to this, which is, what do you see as the biggest, to use an overused word here, the biggest challenge or challenges to the transition? And I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, the obvious problems of having been in a pandemic, not having had people on campuses. So we've got the issues of bringing people back to campus and all of that. What that entails, we have a separate behavioral compact that's still being enforced and with, you know, complaints under those being adjudicated. And then we've got this new campus code, this new student code. So I'm wondering, in any moment, a transition of this kind would be hard, but right now it's really hard. So I wonder if people have any reflections about that.
I would say, one, the behavioral compact is written to be a short-term process, right? Really COVID-19 dependent. I anticipate that there will be shifts with the behavioral compact and also the enforcement, so the compact compliance team. And I think just to be clear, there's not an adjudication in the compliance. It's really just conversations. It's developmental in its nature, and only rises to adjudication when there is a series of sort of egregious behaviors or, you know, a pretty sort of long runway of not testing. And then that's referred to the JA. So because of our code of conduct, this isn't a body in which conduct or where adjudication is happening. But I think that one of the things that we have to do per the code is to give the community time to know that there is a new code, right? So we're working on a website that will have this information. Again, sort of the training and the hope is to really smoothen out some of the challenges. I don't think that we'll eliminate them, all of the challenges of changing to a new code. By doing more education. But I think that there's going to be a cultural shift. You know, we've had a code for 50 years that, you know, as Christina was saying, you know, we hope that the JA language disappears. Like some of what is the sort of sentiment behind saying that, like sort of what is the culture what is elicited or what is the perception of the JA's office, and how does this code shift some of those perceptions, right? Students have referred to it as sort of a punitive, sort of almost legal system, and this is really meant to be developmental, that, and also developmental in the sense that consequences, that there are consequences to our actions, but that actually they don't define us, and that they don't sort of set the tone for what we will always be, but rather give us an opportunity of growth and learning from that, right? So how do we lead with some of that sort of language? How do we make this, that there are moments of partnership that happen even in the conduct office, right? And so what does that look like, and how do we communicate that? And I think that's probably going to be the biggest challenge. I think that there's some technical stuff that Kevin and I are working through, and there's going to be some technical things, right? But I also think that there are some really great opportunities for the JA's office, which has sort of been an island to itself in some ways. This is an opportunity for great integration into a campus community and for the staff there. That comes with other aspects of professional development, greater integration into the campus community, to also be more aware of what's happening in the campus community, because they're in a conversation in which, and in a community in which many of us are student facing. And so there's some excitement there, right? But I think that some of the challenges is changing sort of the culture or the perception of what conduct and what the JA's office is, and what is, and how we see the culture being different in student conduct and community standards.
I concur with all of that it's all an opportunity. My role when I was brought in was to really help the university think about this new policy. How do you take it from paper and to actualize it, theory to practice, right? It took many reads, many presentations that Christina and Marissa have put together to help me also understand this. And I think right now what we're navigating is a lot of that technical stuff, a new director, a hearing panel chair, working with the code counselors. They were one of the first groups that we worked with to figure out what they needed. And where we are now is, how do we then make it educational, bring it to life through website, through conversations, coming to opportunities like this to start that conversation? It's a massive cultural change with a lot of intersections. And so being very strategic about what we're able to do this fall, and then stepping that out. And some of the work that we're doing right now is with the team, is if we're going to make it equitable and fair and restorative, is what type of training and support do they need to do that work? And this connection with the Dean of Students and Vice President area gives us more of those resources that I think are definitely needed, that maybe have been opportunities for growth in the past. So great opportunities on the cusp of doing something new and exciting for Cornell. And I think it's going to take us time to, I like who said maybe earlier, Marissa said, we get to adapt if we need to, because it's all still theoretical. I keep saying to the team, I think this is what it's going to mean when it happens, but until we actually see it, we're going to have to be able to pivot and respond to that. And I think that's exciting work. Hopefully that helped answer.
Okay, so I have two more questions. So the first one is sort of getting, one of the changes to this is that it's no longer a campus code of conduct, it's a student code of conduct. And I think much of the designation of that has been addressed as you look at much of the conversations around changes and reviews speak a lot to the SA and the GPSA, which I think is extremely important. And I wondered if you could maybe speak to where you see the importance of the faculty and staff representation on the UHRBs. I think that, you know, because it was a campus code of conduct before, it made clear sense. And I wondered if you'd had any thoughts around that and how best to address that as the SA and the GPSA look at the code that applies to them. Why are faculty and staff a part of the hearing and review process for us? Because it's our student code of conduct.
I would say that at most institutions, even when it's just the student code of conduct, faculty and staff serve on these committees because they also have a stake in sort of the values and the community and the expectations that we have for the community, and also have great sway and contribute to it. And so this is really sort of, if these are violations to the community, faculty and staff are a part of the community and should be a part of this group that makes some decisions about what happens just in the situation where it's a code of conduct and the university hearing board had students on it that could make some decisions or contribute to the decision as it relates to faculty and staff that were, that went through a hearing process. I think for us, that's a big part of why we would continue to move forward with faculty and staff as a part of these groups.
Thank you. Thank you, Marla. I appreciate that. The other question I had is sort of, topical in that, marijuana legalization has occurred in New York State. And now as you look at this document and the reference from, the recent letter coming out from the university is that marijuana is a federally illegal substance, which I think we all understand. How do you envision, as a student comes into this situation and says, you're coming at me for this, and I can go downtown and I can smoke a joint in front of the police office, but I'm here on campus and you're telling me that I'm gonna face whatever the new term will be. I won't be J8 anymore, whatever the new term might be. How do you look to address that in the coming semester?
I think there should be proactive education for students, right? One of the unique pieces of our code is there's reference to no swimming in the gorge. I would think that's something kind of unique to Cornell's campus code of conduct and in the student code as well. So, providing those expectations, I think, is part of what Marla was talking about earlier, is what does it mean to be part of this community? And there is going to be, I anticipate, that those conversations of, like, I literally could take one step across from campus and be doing the exact same behavior. And in some ways, that's true, right? In many ways, that's true because you're part of this community and there are kind of unique responsibilities and rules that apply for Cornell community members. And so trying to proactively educate students on what the policy says and why it says that is going to be really critical to that piece. But I think the violation is really just one component of it, right? The education in terms of what types of, we call them sanctions, but I think it's also the educational opportunities to help the student understand why this was a violation, what you want to do about the fact that there was a violation, how that might affect your behavior in the future is actually the more important part. And so I think about kind of discussing what the violation is, but also focusing on how do we move forward from here is also a really important part to focus in that conversation.
I think that's a great point to add there to speak to. And I think that I might advocate as well, that's part of the education and that, you do have a new law that many students are going to be wondering why suddenly when I'm here, it's one way, when I'm there, it's another. And what you said is true, like swimming in the gorge is where it's legal is legal. But as a Cornell student, it's, it's in there.
I think the thing that I would add to it is like, it's not just like this. So marijuana is Cornell's not the only place where you could do it in one spot and not do it in another, right? So you could smoke a joint potentially in front of the airport, but it also then becomes a problem when you get on a plane, right? So this is the difference between state and federal, and institutions tend to uphold the federal stance on marijuana and drugs. And so I think that's part of the conversation, right? That there were lots of things. I think if you think about the behavioral compliance, there are lots of things that we set for students in terms of parameters around complying for the safety and health of our community that were expanding in New York State, right? And so, and we sort of took this opportunity to say, hey, we need to still monitor and still sort of safeguard our community for the safety of our community because we're trying something different in our community, right? Attending class in person, those sorts of things that were different than in other spaces around Ithaca. And so I think that there, or even other parts of New York or other states, right? And I think it wouldn't be helpful for us to, I mean, not helpful. And I don't think that's what you're attempting. That's not what I think you're attempting, but you know, you could do lots more stuff in Texas than you could do in New York. And it would be really difficult to say, well, in Texas, I can go without a mask. We can have 40 people in our backyard. And why can't I do that here in Ithaca? So some of this is, and I think part of what happens in a community is that we agree to some community rules that might not be rules in other spaces, in other places. And I think the important part is we just need to be telling students about what are their responsibilities in this community. And I think that's part of this transition is, and not to say that the OJA wasn't doing it, but we have a new opportunity with lots of changes, particularly in student and campus life, to tell students what their responsibilities are and sort of why we're in this space.
Thank you, Marla. I appreciate that. And James Rowe made a comment here that, you know, because this is applies to off-campus behavior, that it, you know, while they could theoretically, you know, utilize marijuana downtown if they were living off-campus, it is an off-campus activity that is prohibited. So another one of those challenges to the prospect. And I understand, I think that's, I agree with Christina and what you said here, Marla, it's about this education and understanding of what is this. And I think Ryan said at one point in the process of going through this, he talked a lot about what is our culture, you know, this student community standards is about less about, you know, this code that tells me I'm going to go through a judicial process and more about what are the standards that we hold dear as a community. And I think that I really applaud that change and that shift in the conversation around this. And I think that education is going to be imperative in that regard. One of the other questions I had here is, I guess this would be a question, I perhaps would turn it first to Kevin because he has sort of an outside perspective and then hearing Marla's perspective as well. So when you talk about the changes to the code, when you outline, Christina, on that slide, the difference between what the current code changes, the process for changing those codes, and now the student code of conduct. As I look at that, I think that resonates to the concern that many students voiced around the ability for one person to be able to make changes effectively, that VP of student and campus life being able to say that person could be vehemently against a certain activity or process or whatever it may be, and really that's the thing they focus on and able to make those changes. So do you see that there is a greater benefit, and how do you think you might communicate that if there is to having this what I would call what looks to be an easier process for changes to the code?
You're asking me from an outsider perspective, correct? Is that what you said?
Correct. Yeah. I want to start with your perspective of having, you know, kind of new to the process.
Yeah. I think it's, again, an opportunity to see how it works, right? I think what Marissa said, when we have some possibly procedural or some quick policy changes that we need to make, it makes it that we can actually do that more quickly, but still underneath the guidance of shared governance. I think that's what's important, that the I can't remember the name of it right now, and I should know that, the review committee that's going to be created would still provide support and oversight with Marla and Ryan to think about what's working, what's not working, what would we want to do differently. That's really what that's about. And when we look at most other models, this is very similar to that model, that it would be reporting up to your student affairs division. To connect it to other student life, student affairs type issues, concerns, and ways that universities think about those types of policies. It also puts, I think someone said this as well, it keeps Ryan and Marla's ear close to what's going on around campus, around behavioral issues, to help inform possible changes. But this isn't out of the ordinary for any other conduct process that I've seen or worked with in the past. And so I think there's definitely benefits to it. And I think, as we said earlier, as we get into it and actually see it come to life, then we can really review it, assess it as a community, and make those recommendations on, and is it working or is it not working?
Thank you very much. And Marla, I want to pose it a little bit different for you as you think about it, because I've worked with Ryan for some time. You've worked with him much closer than I have. And I have great respect for Ryan. And I know that he has the student's interest at the absolute forefront of everything that he does. Is there any concern that if Ryan Lombardi is no longer the VP of Student and Campus Life, as we look to transition of what that means for students' understanding of who's at the helm of this. You know, right now there's a lot of faith and trust, I believe, in Ryan Lombardi, but does this give pause or concern that the transition of staff in that regard, which I hope Ryan stays for a long time. There we go, I got it out. But obviously that's not going to be forever. So does that give you pause or concern that this role and responsibility fits here now, as opposed to with distinctly the assemblies?
No, it doesn't give me pause, because I would hope that if Ryan were to depart, that Cornell would be looking for a leader who is invested in sort of this project of student affairs and student development. And that the person that would take the helm as vice president would have this outlook around conduct, and most likely would be coming from an environment in which conduct is farther along in terms of what is the best practice for student conduct and community standards and responsibility than maybe even where we are currently right now. And so I think Ryan is bringing to us what is sort of Ryan is bringing to us what he's experienced at other institutions, me and Kevin have experienced at other institutions when it comes to conduct, and that most folks that are interested in student affairs roles, the chief student affairs role, vice president role, would have this orientation and framework for what conduct looks like and how it fits into the overall promotion of student campus life and student development and transformational learning in the co-curricular.
Thank you very much. I would hope that's true as well. And I think that it's just an interesting shift, and it was brought up a lot in the conversations and the debates leading up to it. So I just wanted to hear your perspective. I appreciate that answer.
And I would say that, again, like, it would be different if this was like the one standalone that was leaning in that direction, but all of the units within student and campus life are moving in this direction in terms of really developing a true sense of what student affairs and student and campus life is for a college campus, out of a set of competencies that are coming from our national organizations and out of the literature and scholarship and work that speaks to how do you create a rich student experience and help students learn and grow from both, you know, triumphs and failures and mistakes. And so I would say that if this was the standalone that was moving in that direction, then maybe there would be some worry, but all the other units are also moving in that direction as well.
Great, thank you, Marla. And I'll go to Risa with your question, and then we have a question from James, and I think that'll probably be about all that we have time for this evening. Go, Risa.
Okay, well, I'll just give all my questions now and see what you can cover. So along the governance lines, perhaps Kevin and Marla could both reflect on the role of the University Assembly and the role of the CJC. And then related to that, it'd be really interesting, I think, to hear both of your reflections on, you know, what are you really looking for in the director, since the search is going on now, and any reflections on the director? And then a final one, which is a bit different, but on the educational aspect, does that include really educating students about their rights? Because I know we're all always focused on prohibitions, but their rights in terms of academic freedom, freedom of speech. We have a separate policy statement that the trustees did adopt on that, and that, you know, conflict and conflict through demonstrations, protests, et cetera, is part of campus life as well. So I'm wondering if you're including that. So I realize that's a different kind of question. Thanks.
Do you want to tackle? Do you want me to tackle?
If you have some formulated words already, go ahead, you start.
Yeah, I can say on the rights piece, the last question, that's an important part of the education that needs to happen as well. Not only who are we as a community, but when conflict or behavioral issues come up, what are your rights in the process? What are your rights as being a student? The literature, the scholarship, best practice, all talks about that needs to be an important part because it informs students. while they're making decisions, if they're going to decide to go do X, Y, and Z, they know that I have a, there's a part of the process that I get to participate in, and there's resources available. So 100% would be part of what I was thinking through. Marla, I forgot the first two other questions. And they'll come back to me when you start.
It was about the university assembly and the role of the CJC, and then what are you looking for in the director?
Got it.
Hey, can you go back to, can you recast out the first question?
So the question was, what do you see as the role of the university assembly, since Kevin had, you know, stressed governance issues, yep, in regard to amending the code? And there will be other kinds of issues where governance is going to be important. So what do you see as the role of the university assembly and the CJC? And then the second one is
So I think a couple things. One, per the code, we need to have student assembly and GPSA engagement in our search process. And that's an area right now where we're currently struggling because we've had folks who are unable to participate. So we've asked several students, and either not heard back or people have had to respectfully decline due to timing and so, or due to time commitment. And so, you know, I think one way is to help us find, you know, a representative from each one of those, each one of those assemblies to be a part of this process with us. The second is you play a critical role in helping select folks that are going to be dedicated and committed and show up to being a part of these hearings, knowing that they can be long processes. And so we continue to need the UA to help us to vet those folks, right? That's the, as it's written, that is the responsibility of particularly this group. And I think that there's a real sense that we need great partners to help us find those folks, right, that want to commit their time to doing that work. And then I think also to continue to say, like, hey, we see this is going in a good direction. How do we continue to move forward, right? The code also requires that we have conversations with UA or talk to UA about any amendments. And we don't foresee an amendment like, you know, in the next couple of weeks or the next couple of months, but there might be a time where we might say, hey, based on sort of what's changing, you know, what's changing in the culture, right? 25 years ago, you didn't need to have a policy or a practice around sort of social media engagement between students. That might be something that needs to be thought of maybe in more specific detail than sort of the general sort of areas of violation. Right. These are me just hypothetically talking, so I don't want anybody to leave thinking that I have this master plan to create new things. But I think we still need partners to think about those sorts of things. What we're looking for in the director. We're looking for someone who's going to take this model and sort of the philosophy and the spirit of what we're hoping to do in the conduct space and move that forward. We're also looking for someone that can manage a large office, who can sort of navigate our decentralized community and learn our processes and practices, that can facilitate sort of the growth of this office and the transition of this office, and to create the culture that we want for our students. And I think we definitely, there, like, if you look at the job description, there are definitely some technical things that we're hoping that they have. We want them to have previous conduct experience. We want them to have a background in working in higher education on a college campus, dealing with high level, difficult sort of cases and situations. We want a critical thinker. We want someone who can partner well and sit in a space where some people report to them, and then they work closely with two head codes counselors and don't supervise the rest of the codes counselors, right? That can live in sort of that sort of dotted line reporting, mm-hmm, space. You know, we're also looking for someone, and I think that this might have been one of the questions previously, like, oh, students bring in lawyers, we need a lawyer. And that's not necessarily the case. Most of us that work in student affairs at this level of position, and Kevin having been an associate vice president at another institution, We spend a lot of time talking with university counsel. And so just knowing how to access and work with legal colleagues is going to be important. And I think someone that can come in and maybe not necessarily 100% know the Cornell culture, but can definitely adapt and adapt quickly to the nuances, to the quirks and the highlights of this Cornell community to be able to really affect change in this new unit. If you know people, tell them to apply.
Let us know. And I think someone that's going to grow with the code, someone that's going to grow into the role. And I think back to the piece where we were talking about the panel members. We're looking to work with you now, even on that. As we think about the changes in the code, how does the recruitment for the new panel members mirror that? Just from being here the short period of time, significant feedback that it's challenging for us to get hearing panel members. And so what do we do with that data to say, hey, we're not able to get people, so hearings have been moved or postponed. But I think the other is, are we thinking about changes in the fall for specific times for hearings? Because as I sit in a hearing and think about it's midnight, what learning is happening at midnight? So do we need to think about a different structure? I would want to partner with all of you because you recruit and bring those people into the fold. So making sure that they have the information in order to do the job.
James, you asked this question in the chat and I wanted to respond to it about the changes on academics and learning. I would say that we're hopeful that it'll have a positive change on the academics and learning. I think that if you were to chat with some students that are going through the process, particularly due to some parts of the process, they might be feeling really a lot of anxiety, right? A lot of anxiety because in this side of the house, I'm dealing with this sort of situation that's not getting resolved and I wouldn't say this is all of our cases, but we have cases that go for a really long time. At other institutions, there's a commitment to resolve in a certain amount of days, right? So we hope that what this will do is, one, they will be partners in their understanding of what are all the steps and the processes of their case. And then also sort of, what does it look like for us to think about this educationally, right? Like it's not this scary office. You might be scared about sort of the result or just worried because, oh man, I've done something and this could be my potential sanction. But rather, our goal is to say, hey, there is opportunity to grow from this. And even in the moment, and I don't want to Pollyanna and make it seem like, oh yeah, everybody comes in the office and they're like, oh, I'm going to grow from this experience. But rather that our attitude and our approach is, hey, this is a commitment to not only seeing sort of a sanction from the end of this or a result, but rather our commitment to you. And I don't want to say that the JA's office is not doing that. So I don't want to say, you know, that the way that it was structured didn't allow for that, but the way that it's going to be structured allows for more of that. Yeah. And so I think that we're creating an opportunity to help students take less anxiety back out into the classroom. And to also, I think in this part of this is laying out our earlier expectations, right? Like, here's what we expect from our community members. And we know that not everybody's going to meet these goals, but we know that you're trying. We know that people are making an effort. So I think that those are some of the, what I would say are some of the visible sorts of impacts on academics and learning. I think, but Kevin gives a really great example of something where, how could you go into the classroom the next day ready to take on a full lecture or an exam or a quiz when your hearing's gone till 12 p.m., right? And it's not done and you need to go back the next day and do the hearing. But you can't go back the next day because the hearing board can't get quorum to hear the case, right? And so there's a delay. We're hoping that what we do is and I think this is where partnership really helps, is how can we think about doing these hearing board panels at a different time? How can we set some parameters about, hey, we will only do 2 hours and then we will recess? Like, those are some of the things that actually lower anxiety for students and also create an environment where we can safely believe that they could go to class the next day and actually have sort of to be optimally functional to be able to take in a lesson and the learning that needs to happen the next day.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So I want to thank you all, both so much for being here, thanking Christina who had to step out there and Marissa for taking time to give us that code comparison was really, really beneficial. And I'm, I hope that we'll be able to be a part of the education process and the series as the roadshow happens. And I think, you know, I heard a lot of things that really reaffirm what I envision for this student code of conduct to be able to really make this a restorative and a more a less judicial process, you know, as much as possible, and finding ways to make that a less anxiety driven experience for students. I think you spoke to a lot of those things that I think are going to make a major impact and hopefully a positive. I think we all know that there's going to be some challenges in the beginning and understanding for Marla and Kevin, depending on how long you're around as you implement this process. But I do think that there's some challenges there that you've spoken really well to about how to address it. And that education piece, I would just personally advocate that's one of the biggest aspects of this is really educating the community and understanding what the goals and the initiatives are. One thing I am going to reach out to Christina and see if we can get a copy of the slides, because I thought those were tremendous and very beneficial. And I think that anyone coming into the CJC should actually really kind of get that as day one intro onboarding document for them. So I really appreciate Marla and Kevin for you both being here and your time and answering questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Nice
and if
you.
I can get the CJC to hang and we can speak quickly, and I will entertain a motion if we're so inclined to in regards to the minutes that were sent out. We had a delay. There was Dakota had a number of things that kind of came up, and being able to get all those minutes together took some time. So we have them now, and this is sort of our last chance to be able to approve those if so. I think we still have quorum because we have four and we're eight, right? It has to be a five.
Yeah, it has to be a majority.
I thought it was half. All right, well we're done then. There's nothing we can do. Well, in that case, then I say a thank you to y'all for being here tonight, and I'll work out with the Office of Assemblies what we do with all these meeting minutes that are now sitting in limbo for a moment, and how we might be able to move forward. But I appreciate it. This is our last meeting. We won't meet again until the such time is needed. So we really appreciate all the work that everyone here has done, and I'll send that out to everyone as well to let them know how much I appreciate all the work everybody has done to get us here and the time commitment you've had to understanding this process. And congratulations to you, Marissa. Have a great graduation. Sorry,
caught you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And have best of luck to you and your future. And don't hesitate to tune into the CJC meetings if you ever just want to see what's going on. We'll send you the link.
Thank you.
Brandon, can I just ask a quick question? Yeah. Are there any updates about where we are on the UHRB stuff?
Gina, I don't know if you have numbers. We had a pretty good response on the number of folks that extended their appointments. I don't know if we have a final numbers now. And if you don't, Gina, you could send that out maybe afterwards in an email.
Yeah, I don't have them offhand, but we can send those out.
Yeah, that'd be great if you could send out an update on where we are in the UHRB numbers so folks are aware, and then and that would be great. Yeah, and I'll follow up with you on what we do about the meeting minutes.
Sounds good. Thank you all very, very much. Really appreciate your time, energy, and volunteer efforts towards all of this, especially in this last year. So thank you.
Take care. Have a great one.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.